All right, I think I can start now. All right, so the class I've been asked to teach is New Testament Survey. So my job is not to teach you the New Testament, because that would be a 200-hour class. All right, my job is to teach you about the New Testament, all right? So, for example, I say the book of Galatians, and you would know what Galatians is about, the purpose it was written, the author, hopefully you got that one down already, where Galatia is, all right? The themes of the different books of the New Testament, that sort of thing. All right, now, I'm a college professor, all right? So I do things like presenting the syllabus on the first day of class. Robert didn't even, do you even have just kidding, you have a syllabus. So I got a syllabus. Would somebody please hand it out? I'd better keep one copy for myself. And we're going to actually go over the syllabus and talk about grading and tests and quizzes and stuff, all right? Because I'm a college professor, and that's just what I do. It's so obvious I'm a college professor, because I'm ask Josh and Joel how much I'm up on campus, like, all the time. And so the dean of science is constantly harassing me to get me to teach a class. And, you know, I haven't done it yet, but... And by the way, I really appreciated... Did you get the sense that Robert is fired up about his spirituality? Did you get that sense? Yeah. Yeah. And I'm with Robert on that. We taught a lot of classes together. And so Robert gets up there and he teaches a little bit and he preaches a lot, you know? And then I get up there and I preach a little bit and I kind of teach a lot. And so that's why the two of us teaching together has always been really... productive and effective. I think so anyway. So we got a syllabus here. We got a textbook. Casket empty. And by the way, I taught Old Testament Survey in San Diego about 3 years ago. Kyle was there. Evan was there. And so this is the other half. In fact, I have a copy of the Old Testament version. And so casket empty, two different authors. And basically it takes kind of a chronological perspective through the New Testament. Now, I will only somewhat rarely actually refer to this textbook, all right, because this is just another perspective, all right? I will probably take a couple of questions on the test from this textbook. My suggestion is do the reading. Please take notes while you're reading, and then just kind of look over those notes briefly before you take the final exam. Okay, so casket empty. Great. I've got a couple others suggested. Another one is, let me see here. How's this thing working? Hopefully it is actually working. Okay. All right. Yes, a couple other things is a book called Four Portraits, One Jesus. I'll show you a picture of the cover of that one later on. And that's my favorite book, one on the four Gospels. It's very readable. The Palmer's book is quite readable as well. It's taught at, I think both are at kind of freshman and college level as far as the reading goes. So that's not too bad. And so when I'm teaching through Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, which I'll start this weekend, you'll notice probably the perspective that's being taken in that book. Mark Strauss, by the way, I believe he lives in San Diego. And let me see, what's her name? Jennifer Konzen's good friend with him, if you know Jennifer Konzen. Anyway, and then this other book by some guy. Oh, John Oakes, John M. I don't know. From Shadow to Reality, a little bit on how to find the New Testament in the Old Testament. That might be worth reading. There's copies back there, both books. All right, anyway, schedule. We're going to do the background to the New Testament. And tomorrow, I'll do background to the New Testament today. Tomorrow, I'll be doing Matthew and Mark. We'll see. We may get into Luke a little bit, and then you can read the rest. You see the reading. By the way, both Robert's course, I believe, you're supposed to do the reading ahead of time. Is Robert still here? No. Okay, he had to go. Okay, so we expect you to do the reading ahead of time, except obviously today we didn't expect you to do the reading ahead of time because you didn't have it. So for March 26th, I want you to read the first four chapters. It's not that big a deal, honestly. To read about a 350, 400-page book, in one class. That's really not too bad. All right, so anyway, what we're going to have is we're going to have, you got your course rationale, your course description, course outcomes. That's all boring stuff that professors think they need to do. We got assignments, reading 20%, three short quizzes 20%, final exam 60%. The final exam will be straightforward, true, false, multiple choice kind of stuff. And the way you're going to prepare for the final exam is just kind of go over the notes. Just keep going over the notes, and then just review the notes one more time, take the final exam, okay? I try to make it reasonably easy. I don't know if I succeed. All right, that's pretty much the whole course. I even have a grade scale there. All right, anyway. That's the syllabus. All right, so background to the New Testament. Let's see here. Oh, yeah, there's the grading right there. I forgot it was in there. Okay, there's the schedule, intro to the New Testament. All right, Romans 5, 6. Says here, you see, at just the right time, when you were still powerless, Christ died for the ungodly. And I want to talk about sort of the context. Where does the New Testament fit in the whole picture of history, in light of the Old Testament and things like that? But according to Paul, at just the right time in all human history, there could not have been a more perfect time. Because if Jesus had come earlier, it wouldn't have had the effect that it had. If he came later, less people would have had the opportunity to be saved. The right time in history, the right place. Where else but Palestine? If you're going to send the Savior into the world, where would you send him to? But the crossroads of Europe, Africa, and Asia, right there. The perfect time. For the first time in all human history, there was a lingua franca. And by the way, in my notes it says lingua French, because it fixed my... I hate that. Don't you hate when your computer fixes your stuff? It's not lingua French. It's lingua franca. All right? The notes are at my website. The PowerPoint's at my website. So take notes if you want. But the notes are there. In fact, you could just go to evidenceforchristianity.org, pull up the notes, and just look at them so you don't have to, take a whole bunch of notes. The right place, a time when, for the very first time, because of what Alexander the Great had done, he created a, not literally worldwide culture, because the culture in Central America, okay. But I'm talking about a culture that spread from Spain to India. And a language. And the Pax Romana, you might have heard of the Pax Romana, which was created by Octavian, by Augustus. For the first time in history, the world, at least the Mediterranean world, was at relative peace. And not only that, the Romans, for the first time, built roads. So you could go from Spain to Mesopotamia in just a few months. And Matthew 5:17. Just the right time spiritually. Matthew 5:17. Come on, John. There's my coffee. Thank you, Evan. You are welcome, sir. Yeah, why do they put that thing in there? Doing Starbucks with one hand. There you go. Okay, good. Matthew 5:17, which, by the way, in my opinion, is the theme verse of Matthew. We probably will get into Matthew tomorrow. Here we go. It says, "Do not think that I've come to abolish the law of the prophets. I've not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them." So then the New Testament then is the fulfillment of the Old Testament. Jesus fulfilled the law in so many ways. How can I count the ways? He fulfilled the law in that he was the first human being who ever actually obeyed it. The very first one. Not only, not safe there. Not only was he first one to completely and obey it, he also took the penalty of the law. He fulfilled the law in that he fulfilled it. The types, prefigures, foreshadows that saturate the Old Testament. He was those things. And also, he fulfilled the law in that he completed it. In other words, the Old Testament, he says, it was said to you of old, but I say to you, you know what, this is kind of what God had in mind all along. So the New Testament then, to understand the New Testament, you have to understand that it is the fulfillment and the completion of the Old Testament. And by the way, the Old Testament is almost three times as long as the New Testament. And although this is New Testament survey, my goal is that my Bible be dirty all the way across. I'm not there yet. It's dirtier on this side than it is on that side. And if you look, there's this little white spot right here. There's this white spot right here. So apparently I've not been studying Jeremiah lately. All right? Jeremiah is still clean. All right? So I want to talk a little bit about the background of the New Testament being the Old Testament, okay? And then I'll talk a little bit about the time between the Testaments. But the Old Testament anticipates the New Testament in uncountable ways. That's why I'm going to give a plug for that book, From Shadow to Reality, one more time, because I think it'll help you to understand the New Testament. So we see captivity in Exodus, captivity in Egypt, and then Exodus from Egypt as a foreshadow of our captivity and our Exodus from captivity. And then we see again captivity of Judah in Babylon, and then their restoration from Babylon to the promised land, again as a foreshadow of our captivity to sin and our restoration to a relationship with God that we find in the New Testament. In the Old Testament, we see a father offering his one and only son as a sacrifice. And where does he do it? On Mount Moriah, the same city where Jerusalem was built, where God offered his one and only son. And it's so interesting because Abraham left for that mountain. On the third day, he received his son back as if it were from the dead. Hebrews 11:18, figuratively. And then we see Isaac going up the mountain, carrying the very wood that was going to be used for his sacrifice up the mountain, the same mountain that Jesus carried the wood up, which was going to be for his sacrifice. So again, the New Testament is the fulfillment and the completion of the Old Testament. If we don't understand that, then we're not getting the New Testament. In the Old Testament, a favorite son is betrayed by his brothers for 20 pieces of silver, the approximate price of a slave at that time, and sent down into Egypt, where, of course, he escapes from slavery in Egypt. That kind of reminds me of another favorite son, about whom a jealous, powerful man thought he could somehow overthrow him. So what did both jealous kings do? They tried to kill all the male children. You know what I'm saying? So the New Testament is the Old Testament revealed, which is what Jesus said there in Matthew 5:17. In Hebrews 11:1, it says, out of Egypt I called my son. Let me count the ways. Out of Egypt, God called Joseph. More than 400 years after he died, he came out of Egypt. Out of Egypt, God called Moses, because Egypt is where you're held captive. You're held captive to sin. You're held captive to Satan, because Satan, Pharaoh, is your master. Out of Egypt, God called Israel. So where did Jesus have to go? Just about the first event in the New Testament. Where does Jesus go? He goes to Egypt. After this jealous king, we're talking about Moses, right? We're also talking about Herod. Right after that, where's he going? The whole jealousy of the king is sending him down to Egypt because out of Egypt I called my son. And every one of you were called out of Egypt. And you're here this morning. So there's that. there's that. And then there's the prophetic background. So I want to talk about, generally in a New Testament survey, what you talk about is sort of kind of what happened between the Testaments. All right, so I'll talk about that a little bit. And by the way, there is a book called Between the Testaments. It's by Pfeiffer. And it's this thick. It's an hour and a half reading. And it kind of fills in sort of the history of what's going on between the Testaments. But really, we have a history book of the period between the Testaments. But the cool thing, it was written before the period between the Testaments. It's called the Book of Daniel. So what we're going to do is, and by the way, in Casket Empty, he covers it, the same material, different way. So I'm going to use Daniel 8 to cover the period between the Testaments. Daniel 8 and Daniel 11, in Casket Empty, he does it a different way. Same stuff, different way to cover it, okay? So I'm going to go to Daniel 8. All right, so we got the period of these different kingdoms. You know the Daniel 2 thing with the head of gold, the chest of silver, the belly and thigh of bronze, legs of iron, clay, mixed, all that sort of stuff. Those are the four kingdoms that occupy the time between the time of the Old Testament and the New Testament. I think I might have like maps or something like that. There we go. So this is going to be the Persian Empire prophesied in Daniel. And this is going to be the Greek Empire of Alexander the Great, which will split into four separate kingdoms. When Alexander the Great dies, one of those, out of one of those, there'll come a fifth. Seleucus, you know, and then, you know, all that sort of stuff. You guys know all this stuff already, right? Oh, no, you don't. All right, that's why we're covering it. Okay, that's why we're covering it. Okay? Because honestly, to understand the New Testament, you kind of have to know what happened between the Old Testament and the New Testament, okay? But the cool thing is, it's in Daniel. Daniel is a history book of the future. If you walk into the library and ask, can you send me to the section in the library of books that predict the future? And the librarian, I was about to say she, so gender biased, you know, he or she will say, no, we don't have any books like that. Yes, you do. It's called the Bible. It's Daniel. All right. So let's read Daniel 8, verse 3 and 4. So Daniel 8 is essentially a little brief history of between 400 BC and, like, you know, 26 AD. Okay, in the third year of King Belshazzar, Daniel had a vision after the one had already appeared to me. In my vision, I saw in the citadel in the Susa in the province of Elam. In the vision, I was beside the Ulai Canal. And by the way, if you're beside the Ulai Canal, you're in the city of Susa, and you're looking towards the west, and you're looking from Persia through Mesopotamia and Iraq and all that area towards Greece. That's what you're doing, okay? I looked up, and there before me was a ram with two horns standing beside the canal, and the horns were long. One of the horns was longer than the other, but it grew up later. I watched the ram as it charged to the north, to the west rather, to the north and to the south. No animal could stand against it. None could rescue from its power. It did as it pleased, and it became great. So this two-horned ram is the Persian Mede Empire. And actually, the Persian Mede Empire partially overlaps with the Old Testament because it was Cyrus. Cyrus was the king of the Persian Mede Empire. It's kind of interesting because in Isaiah chapter 44 and 45, Cyrus is actually named. About 150 years before he's born, he's actually named. That's kind of cool. So anyway, he charges first to the west, and Cyrus took Lydia. And then he charged to the north, he took Babylon. And he charged to the south, and he took Egypt. But in the process, if you take Lydia, Babylon, and Egypt, guess what else you take? Kind of look at a map. Lydia, kind of Turkey. Babylon, kind of Iraq. Yeah. Egypt. What else do you take? The Promised Land, okay? So this is when, as Daniel prophesied, the Jews came under the Persian Empire. And then Daniel 8, 5 through 8, he says, then the next thing's going to happen. And by the way, Cyrus treated the Jews very well, amazingly well. He said to the Jews, go back and build your temple. He said that in around 538 BC. And then, you know, 18 years later, Darius had to say, hey, dudes, how come you haven't built the temple yet? That's the book of Zechariah and Haggai. But anyway, that they finally did. All right, as I was thinking about this, suddenly a goat with a prominent horn between his eyes came from the west. crossing the whole earth without touching the ground, it came towards the two-horned ram I had seen standing beside the canal, and he charged at it in a great rage. I saw it attack the ram furiously, striking the ram, shattering its two horns. The ram was powerless to stand against it. The goat knocked it to the ground, trampled on it, and none could rescue the ram from its power. The goat became very great, but at the height of his power, the large horn was broken off, and in its place, four prominent horns grew up towards the four winds of heaven. And who is this goat with the big, long horn? His name is Alexander. So Alexander, in 335 B.C., with an army of 30,000, crossed the Dardanelles Straits. Persia had 200,000 standing army. 3 years later, Persia was gone. It's cool because, and by the way, when Alexander came to Jerusalem, according to Josephus, when Alexander came to Jerusalem, they brought him and showed him Daniel. Now, probably they didn't show him verse, they probably skipped verse 8. I think they said, well, show him verse 8. We're just going to show him verse 6 and 7, okay? And so and by the way, for the first 150 years, the Greeks treated the Jews quite well. But that was under the Ptolemies. Do you know who the last of the Ptolemies was? The last Ptolemaic ruler. It was a girl. Do you know who her name was? Yeah, Cleopatra. Cleopatra. And by the way, Cleopatra is in the book of Daniel, sort of. It's in Daniel chapter 11, starting in verse 35. I'm not kidding. All right, so we got this horn gets broken off, and then four horns come into place. What happens is Alexander died 35 years old. But what he did was he set about this process. I'm telling you, God was behind all this stuff. I know that because he prophesied it. And then it happened, and because it happened, the Christian church was born in a Hellenized world. The culture within which the church in the New Testament is written is Hellenistic. Hella, Greece. I was going to say, make a joke about Hella, but all those jokes are not good Christian jokes, so we'll move on, okay? So he dies, and you get Antigonus, Cassander, Lysimachus, and Ptolemy. And so we have four succeeding things. And then a fifth. So got it. Alexander dies. Four succeeding Greek kingdoms came, which kind of ruled and Hellenized all of the Near East from Egypt to the borders of India and through Greece. Okay, but then, verse 9, the next stage, this is the time between the Testaments leading up to when Jesus came. Out of one of them, out of one of those four, Lysimachus, Ptolemy, those other guys, it's all in the notes. You don't need to memorize. I'm not going to ask you to name them, all right? All right. You probably need to know for the test, Persia, Greece, you know, Rome, you need to know that. Out of one of them came another horn, which started small but grew in power to the south and to the east into the beautiful land. It grew until it reached the host of the heavens. By the way, we're about to see the most important event that occurred between the Old Testament and the New Testament. The year 167 BC. Got it? It grew until it reached the host of the heavens. It threw some of the starry hosts down to the earth. It trampled on them. It set itself up to be as great as the commander of the army of the Lord. It took away daily sacrifice from the Lord. His sanctuary was thrown down because of rebellion. That's why it happened. Because of rebellion. Whose rebellion? People of God's rebellion. Because of rebellion, the Lord's people and the daily sacrifice were given over to it. It prospered in everything it did, and truth was thrown to the ground. His name is Antiochus. This is Alexander. All right. What happened was Alexander died. Four empires rose up. And then out of one of them, out of Ptolemy, Ptolemy had a general. His name was Seleucus. All right, and Seleucus created a fifth empire. And then Seleucus and Ptolemy, you know, and I shouldn't get into Daniel, but Daniel, you know, Daniel 11, the king of the north and the king of the south, that's Seleucus and Ptolemy fighting it out for about 200 years. But it's all heading towards the main point, which is Antiochus Epiphanes. This is Antiochus's, this is the first and. This is Seleucus, the guy who set up the Seleucid Empire. And here is his great-great-great-great-grandson, Antiochus Epiphanes, which means Antiochus, God came down. But the Jews called him Antiochus Epimenes, the madman. All right, and what he did was he had a little thing with Rome, and it's just all complicated. It's all right there in Daniel in great detail, hundreds of years before it happened. But the bottom line is he decided to go after the Jews and force them to Hellenize, to have Olympic-type stadium in their city and to no longer worship God. And he killed a pig, and he smeared the blood around the temple. And it says right here, he's going to set himself up to be as great as the Prince of Hosts. What he did was, he actually took an image of Zeus, put it right in the Holy of Holies, but the face on the image was the face of Antiochus Epimenes. By the way, this is in the Bible. All this is in the Bible, not just in Daniel. It's also in 1 Maccabees. All right? 1 Maccabees. All right, here it is. It's right after Esther. All right, so 1 Maccabees chapter 1, verse 46. By the way, I have this recurring dream that I'm reading my Bible and I find a book in there that I'd never seen before. This is kind of a recurring dream for me. So 1 Maccabees is kind of like that. I just have a Jerusalem Bible. Or you get a New American Version. It's in there. All right, here we go. Verse 46 and 47. Okay. It says here, the king also sent instructions by messenger to Jerusalem, the towns of Judah, directing them to adopt customs foreign to the country, banning holocausts and other sacrifices, libations from the sanctuary, profaning Sabbaths and feasts, defiling the sanctuary and the sacred ministers, building altars, precincts, and shrines, idols, sacrificing pigs and unclean beasts, leaving their sons uncircumcised, and prostituting themselves to all kinds of impurity and abomination. So this was the most intense persecution the Jews have ever undergone until, I suppose, probably in the 1930s, when it was, I would say, even worse. So all this happened. In 1 Maccabees, that's right, I want to read verse 57. I'll just read it from my notes. On the 15th of Chislev, in the year 145, which is 167 BC, he erected the abomination of desolation in the temple. And according to Daniel, this would last for 2,300 evenings, which is 1,150 days, which is like 3 years and 1 month. And then 3 years and 1 month later, the Maccabees came along. And that's who the book of Maccabees is named after. And then, so what they did was they kicked that guy, they kicked him out, and then they lit the menorah. And there was only enough oil for one day. But it lasted miraculously for 8 days. And what do they call that? Hanukkah. And by the way, in John, I believe it's in John, I believe it's in John 8, but I might have to correct me. I'll get it right when we do that in the notes. Jesus is in Jerusalem on the Feast of Dedication. The Feast of Dedication is Hanukkah. All right, that's what they call it. So anyway, so what happened was most of the Jews said, it's cool. Yeah, we've got a little Greek. You know, we'll kind of be a little bit Jewish, but we'll have Greek hairstyles and we'll go to Greek games and, you know, we won't. But on the other hand, in 2 Maccabees, you read about the woman who had her children circumcised. They killed all 7 of her sons before they killed her. It was a pretty rough time. But this is when the Hasidim formed. The Hasidim were the devoted ones. And they eventually became the devout. They became the Pharisees. This is when by the way, the Pharisees are the good guys. I'm telling you, Pharisees are the good guys. The Sadducees are the bad guys, right? Right? You know the song, I Don't Want to Be a Sadducee? That's not a very good song, but we sang that thing back in the day. All right. They were the ones who refused to compromise. They would not blend with Greek culture. And so the Maccabean dynasty was established, and the Pharisees always opposed the kind of the priestly elite. And the priestly elite took the power under the Maccabean dynasty, and they became the Sadducees. And the Sadducees were the rich, powerful elite,
And they only used the first five books of the Old Testament, and they didn't believe in the resurrection. Why did this happen? Because of rebellion, Daniel 8:12. Because of rebellion, because God is in control. God has always been in control. And then in Daniel 8:25 it says, "But he will be destroyed, but not by human power. And it'll take 1,150 days. That's exactly what happened. And in 1 Maccabees 4, 36 through 40, I don't have time to read it, you can see the establishment of the holiday that we call Hanukkah and the lighting of the menorah. And they considered Judas Maccabeus a deliverer of Israel. They considered him to be a prefigure of the Messiah, as David is prefigure of the Messiah. And they believed Hezekiah also was a prefigure of the Messiah. So during this time is when the Pharisees began, and they had sort of a separate ministry. It's when you began to have synagogues taking a more important role. Basically, the synagogues were there to give Jews a way to worship that didn't involve the temple, because you could have a synagogue anywhere. And the Sadducees controlled the temple. Who really hated that? Oh, the Essenes. The Essenes, they're there in Qumran. You've heard about the Dead Sea Scrolls. The Essenes, they were the ascetics. They were the monks. They were the devoted ones. But then in Daniel 11:36 through 45, I can't remember if I have a slide about this. All right. Yes, I do. In Daniel 11:36 through 45, it describes this great final battle when the Greek power was destroyed. It's the Battle of Actium. And what happened in the Battle of Actium, 31 BC, that's when Rome finally defeated the last of the Greek powers. Now, Rome came to Jerusalem in 63 BC. His name was Pompey. And so Pompey conquered the promised land for Rome, but then the Parthians took over, and Rome, they don't usually tell that, Rome lost power over Jerusalem. But then in 31 BC, as prophesied, of course, by Daniel, the final overthrow of the last Greek power under Cleopatra and her friend. All right. Anthony, thank you. Very good. Anthony. And then, so Rome took over. Now we're getting close, folks. We're getting close to the New Testament. So what's going to happen next? So it turns out there's this guy, Herod. And Herod, he would just go with whoever had the money, whoever had the power, whoever had the money. So Herod, he was working with Brutus and Cassius and Octavian. Brutus and Cassius and Anthony. But then when the Battle of Actium, when they lost, Octavian comes in. Herod says, "I'm with you, Octavian. I was totally loyal to Mark Anthony, so now I'm going to be totally loyal to you." And Octavian, he said, "All right, good." So he set up Herod. So who's Herod? Herod is an Idumean. Idumean. What country back then in Old Testament is Idumean? What's that sound like? In Old Testament, there were the Moabites, and there were the Ammonites. The Edom, right, Edom. Edom was to the southeast of the Dead Sea, and that's where Idumea was. And so the Romans were smart. What they're going to do is they're going to give power to a less important group of people, the Idumeans. So Herod was sort of half Jew. Herod is to Judaism in some ways like the Samaritans were. The Samaritans were sort of half-breed Jewish. The Idumeans would have said they're Jews, and they would have worshipped at the temple. But the Jews would not have accepted them as being truly Jewish. So what happens is, Rome is too busy ruling their whole empire, so they choose this Idumean guy, Herod, in 31 BC, and he begins to rule. And he began a great amount of construction. Most famously, he rebuilt the second temple. He rebuilt the temple built under Zerubbabel and Haggai and Zechariah. All right? So then, not long before he died, this baby was born in a small town about 15 miles from Jerusalem. The year was 6 B.C. By the way, Jesus was not born in 0 B.C. By the way, there was no 0 B.C. anyway. So there's 1 B.C. and then there's 1 A.D. So you can't get born in 0 B.C., you know. That's actually not a possibility. Herod learns about that, right? And he decides that that's not acceptable because, you know, the wise guys, those wise guys come from the east. And they say, man, we came to worship the king. He's there, wait a minute, I'm the king. What are you talking about? Well, I don't know, we saw this star. And, you know, we live there. There's a lot of Jews over there in Iraq. There was a huge Jewish population in what is Iraq, Mesopotamia. A lot of influence, obviously. So they came and they said, yeah, we came to worship the king. He's there, okay, great, awesome. Let me know where he is. Well, you know that story. So then he decides to kill all the male children. And we're kind of getting into the New Testament. We're almost there. So that was in 6 B.C. Jesus is born, and in 4 B.C. Herod kicks the bucket, right? Herod's rule included Galilee. It included Idumea, south of Judea. It included Judea and Samaria. And to get the New Testament, you have to kind of know about Idumea, but you have to know a little bit about Samaria. Who are those Samaritans? The Samaritans have been around for a while because you got Samaritans there in the book of Nehemiah, don't you? Yeah, you got some Samaritans. So what it was is, so there's Galilee, there's a Jewish population in Galilee, and then there's a Jewish population around Jerusalem, and also a large Jewish population in Alexandria and over there in Iraq, and between was Samaria. So what happened is when the northern kingdom was destroyed in 722 B.C., it wasn't the Babylonians, it was the Assyrians. They basically wiped out the population, probably left behind a few peasants, and they brought in people from outside, and they populated that area. But they kind of adopted a kind of Judaism. They had what was called the Samaritan Pentateuch. They only used the first five books. And they read it not in Hebrew, but in the Samaritan language. And so the Jews, they didn't think much about the Samaritans at all. Again, we're just setting the background for the New Testament. Now, let's go to Malachi 3, verse 1 and 2. We're almost there. We're getting close to being able to talk about the book of Mark. We're going to start with Mark? Yeah, we're going to start with Mark. We're going to do that. Malachi 3, verse 1 and 2. So again, as you think about the New Testament, think about it as completely anticipated in so many ways in the Old Testament. Malachi 3, verse 1 and 2 says, I will send my messenger who will prepare the way before me. Then suddenly the Lord you are seeking will come to his temple. The messenger of the covenant whom you desire will come, says the Lord Almighty. And who is that messenger? Who is the one calling in the desert, make straight the paths for the Lord? His name? No. Close. Close. Because you know what? Back in the day, way, way, way back in the day, like 35 years ago, I actually was a minister in San Diego, and they had me in charge of the baptisms. They did every Sunday. I don't know why they did that, because you know what that sets up, right? I've had so many people say, you baptized me. I say, I did? I don't remember that. Anyway. Yeah. But no. The other John the Baptist. Right. And then there's a Malachi 4, 5, and 6. The very last thing said, not in the Jewish Old Testament, by the way, in our Old Testament, because theirs ends in 2 Chronicles, just so you know. Yeah, the Jewish Old Testament ends in 2 Chronicles, right? When Jesus said from such and such to Zechariah. He's talking about the guy Zechariah who was killed in 2 Chronicles. So there's a place where Jesus says, from somebody to Zechariah, you guys are always killing the prophets. No, that's Stephen. It's Acts chapter 7. I apologize. Acts chapter 7. And basically saying from the beginning of the Old Testament to the end of the Old Testament in 2 Chronicles. Of course, the Jews didn't have 2 Chronicles, by the way. They just had Chronicles. But never mind. I'm going in the wrong direction here. We better get back to Malachi chapter 4, verse 5 and 6. The point is this. The next thing to happen is the Messiah is going to come. The whole Old Testament at just the right time, Romans 5, 6, at the exact right time and place and situation in history. Remember the law of my servant Moses, the decrees and laws I gave him at Horeb and all Israel. See, I will send the prophet Elijah to you before the great and dreadful day of the Lord comes. He will turn the hearts of the parents to their children, the hearts of the children to the parents, or else I will come and I will strike the land with total destruction, which happened in 70 AD, almost exactly 40 years after they killed God's son. If you think it's an accident, it was almost exactly 40 years, you're wrong. That is not an accident. Who is this Elijah? It's John the Baptist. In Luke 1:17, Jesus said, or Luke said, he came in the spirit and in power of Elijah. And Jesus said in Matthew 11:14, he is the Elijah who was to come. So let's talk about Jewish expectations. Okay, Rome at its height, Jewish messianic expectations. Here I'm borrowing a fair amount, actually, from Casket Empty on this. Some of it's my own stuff, but some of it's from Casket Empty. So the Jews were expecting a Messiah, right? Now, if you were to take a poll of Jews living in Jerusalem in 26 AD, what's the Messiah going to be about? You'd get a variety of opinions. If you were to ask the Essenes, they would have said, well, which one? They may not. That's what scholars say, and that's exactly true. So, some Jews expected a conquering Messiah. And you can find messianic prophecies that clearly point that way. Other Jews expected a suffering Messiah, but not very many. Because who would want to anticipate a suffering Messiah? Isaiah 53. But the Essenes especially predicted a priestly Messiah. So which were they going to get? A conquering Messiah, a suffering Messiah, or a priestly Messiah? They got all three, but the whole conquering Messiah thing didn't quite fit their model, did it? But we know in Daniel chapter 2, at the time of those kings, in the time of the Roman kings, a kingdom will be established that will overcome all the kingdoms, and it will itself endure forever. Old Testament, here I'm practically word for word copying from Palmer. They expected a kingdom of God as a coming reign of God. Zechariah 14, verse 9. How am I doing? I've got about 3 or 4 minutes. That's fine. Because I got another 45 minutes after that. That's great. Zechariah 14, verse 9. Kyle's studying Zechariah. Zechariah is awesome stuff. It's awesome stuff. I got some pretty good notes on Zechariah at my website. The Lord will be king over the whole earth. And on that day, there will be one Lord, and His name the only name. So one Jewish expectation was for a conquering king. Another Jewish expectation was for a royal son of man. By the way, is Jesus son of God or is He son of man? Jesus is perfectly God and He's perfectly man. And Jesus was the son of man, or woman, if you will. And He was the Son of God. I'd like to have analyzed His chromosomes, you know. 23 of them from Mary? All right, He definitely didn't get a Y chromosome from Mary. I'm pretty sure about that. That's one of those mysteries. They expected a son of David. Perhaps beyond a conquering king, the most common expectation of a Messiah was a son of David. Well, wait a minute. What is the son of David going to be? A conquering king, right? In 2 Samuel 7, verse 14, David's covenant is, There will never fail to have a king over the people of Israel. Whoops. Except for the 400 years in between. All right. Another thing they expected was that the Messiah would bring in atonement for sin. That's in Daniel 9, verse 24. It's also, you probably knew that, Isaiah 53, verse 6. Another messianic expectation was that there would be a new covenant. And that's, of course, famously in Jeremiah 31, 31 through 34. But also, more obscurely, in Hosea 2, 14 through 20. Another messianic expectation was when the Messiah came, there would be an outpouring of the Holy Spirit. And that's in Joel 2, 28 and 29. Another messianic expectation is that the promises to Abraham would be fulfilled in the Messiah. That's in Genesis 22, 18. And Isaiah 2, 2. I better stop right there because it's now 3:45 and 30 seconds. You need 15 minutes break. So we'll see you in 15 minutes.
Come on, John.
Turn off that fire hose.